Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have an update on efforts to reduce the high number of deaths in San Diego County jails, as well as a call by civil rights activists who want racial data on jail deaths to be released. Hear about new help for renters in La Mesa. And then, details on the lifting of indoor mask mandates in San Diego County starting February 15th, an action that differs from the advice of federal health officials. On Green Scene, hear the shocking results of a study at Johns Hopkins University, the nation's most prestigious medical school, which found radiation from cell phones and power lines is harmful to wildlife and to humans. We have good news today for pet lovers and would-be pet owners. Sheriff's deputies now have microchip scanners to help bring lost pets home faster, and Grossmont Center is holding a mega pet adoption clinic this Saturday. Our newsmaker interview today is with Joseph Rocha, a Democratic candidate challenging State Senator Brian Jones for the newly redrawn 40th State Senate District in San Diego and East County. Then, we'll have some national news headlines from Public News Service, including the latest on who President Biden is considering for a Supreme Court nominee, a scandal brewing over potentially classified documents that former President Trump took home to Mar-a-Lago, and why you may find delays at the IRS this tax season. And finally, from California News Service, hear about a bill that would provide money to help low-income California State University students pay living expenses. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. At least 185 people have died in San Diego County jails from 2006 to 2020, according to the California State Auditor, who has called for the state legislature to take action. Now, Reverend Shane Harris with the People's Association of Justice Advocates in San Diego is asking the county's Law Enforcement Review Board for a racial breakdown of those deaths, as well as data on how many of those who died ever came before a judge. In a press conference where he was joined by other human rights advocates and local pastors, Harris said there is a crisis in local jails unlike any other county in the state. Indeed, San Diego County has the highest number of jail deaths in recent years of any major metropolitan area in California. The causes of death include assaults, drug overdoses, COVID-19, suicides, natural causes, and more. Reverend Harris calls for leadership to solve this crisis, stating, "People should not be facing the death penalty when doing time." Although many of the offenders who died were awaiting court hearings on minor offenses, Harris says they are, quote, "rapidly being executed not by the state, but by a jail system that isn't properly addressing mental health and lack of medical care," unquote. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
To help struggling families impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, the City of La Mesa has announced expansion of its current mortgage assistance program to also include rent payment relief for residents. Applications for rental assistance will be accepted starting Monday, February 14th. La Mesa Mayor Mark Arapostasis says, "We urge our residents who need help with mortgage or rent payments to apply and help us get the word out about this vitally important program. The maximum award amount is $5,000 per household to help with past due balances or future mortgage or rent payments. Applications will be accepted until program funds are exhausted. For questions about the program, you can call 619-643-6202. That number again is 619-643-6202. Or find details at eastcountymagazine.org in our homes section. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. Starting February 15th, fully vaccinated people will no longer have to wear masks indoors in most places in San Diego County as the COVID-19 Omicron outbreak wanes. Well-fitted masks will still be required indoors for people who are not fully vaccinated. A person is considered fully vaccinated 2 weeks after getting two doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines or one shot of the Johnson & Johnson immunization. Everybody, regardless of vaccination status, must still wear a mask on public transit, in schools and daycares, healthcare settings, detention centers, senior facilities, homeless and emergency shelters, and cool zones. The county change follows the California Department of Health lifting the mask mandate statewide, although counties are free to have stricter rules, and some still do, such as San Francisco and Los Angeles. But the action runs counter to advice provided by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, which continues to recommend face masks, especially N95 or KN95 masks, as the best way to prevent spread of the Omicron COVID-19 variant. While the changes come as relief to many pandemic-weary residents, they also raise some problems. First, relying on the honor system without checking vaccination status means there's no way to be sure that an unmasked person behind you in that grocery store line is vaccinated. Second, vaccine effectiveness drops sharply over time, yet there's no requirement for individuals to have the booster shot before taking off masks around others. While students must stay masked for now, due in part to low vaccination rates among young people, the County Board of Supervisors voted on February 8th to ask the state to phase out masking in schools in a safe and responsible manner. In East County, some parents and board members have also been calling for the mask mandate to be lifted, and at least one school board member, Jill Barto at Cajon Valley, has been defying the mask mandate during school board meetings. The pandemic is not over, although it has improved. The county reports 119 new deaths between January 2nd and February 4th. The case rate is triple among unvaccinated people versus fully vaccinated and boosted individuals, and it's somewhere in between for those that are vaccinated but not yet boosted. Over the last 2 weeks, over 13% of tests locally have been positive, although the actual rate may be higher since county figures do not include results of at-home tests that are now widely in use. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, urges people to get fully vaccinated and get booster shots. She says people who are not fully vaccinated are more likely to become infected compared to people who have received all the recommended doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, including the booster. And she adds, the vaccines are the best protection there is to prevent people from getting seriously ill, ending up in the hospital, or worse, dying. The region has plenty of COVID-19 vaccines and booster doses now, with over 400 vaccination sites. You can make an appointment or find a site near you by calling 833-422-4255 or by visiting the coronavirus-sd.com website. Again, that's coronavirus-sd.com, and the phone is 833-422-4255.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
A growing body of scientific studies shows that electromagnetic fields from the extremely low frequencies common to power lines and radio frequency radiation, the kind from cell towers and mobile devices, may be harmful to wildlife as well as humans. A three-part review of the literature recommends the feds regulate electromagnetic radiation as pollution. B. Blake Levitt is author of two books on the subject and lead author of the study. She says RF radiation, even at low levels, caused harm in every animal model studied, especially bees and birds.
They depend on the Earth's natural magnetic fields for orientation, migration, food-finding abilities, mating, nest and den building, territorial maintenance and defense.
The telecom industry says its products and towers are safe and comply with all federal regulations for human exposure. The study authors want the feds to create exposure standards for wildlife and plants to designate the air as critical habitat and then regulate electromagnetic radiation as an energetic pollutant. Study co-author Albert Manville is an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins and a retired biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says we can't let industry profits override environmental concerns.
Yet the industry has proceeded going ahead. Now we have 5G rolling out in massive quantities without due diligence to determine are these sources of radiation safe not only to humans but to wildlife. And the answer is no, they're not.
Dr. Joel Moskowitz is director of the Center for Family and Community Health at UC Berkeley. He says the problem is only going to grow.
The industry is putting up something like 800,000 small cell sites around the country, roughly doubling or tripling the current number of cell towers. So our ambient levels of exposure are going to increase dramatically within the next few years.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
One in every three pets will get lost sometime in their lifetime. Fortunately, the San Diego County Sheriff's Department has a new way to help lost pets get home safely. Deputies can now scan lost pets for microchips, thanks to a generous donation from County Animal Services. 20 pet microchip readers have been distributed to sheriff's stations and substations. The idea arose after a German Shepherd named Lucy got frightened by fireworks and ran away from home. The Ramona Sheriff substation posted her information on social media, but deputies had to wait until the morning for county animal control officers to scan Lucy for a microchip. Director Kelly Campbell saw the heartwarming story and collaborated with Undersheriff Kelly Martinez to arrange donation of the microchip scanners and help reunite owners with their pets as quickly as possible. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Elijah McKee.
If you're looking for puppy love or a pet that's the cat's meow just in time for Valentine's Day, Grossmont Center in La Mesa will hold the annual Cupids and Canines event on February 12th. Around 24 animal rescue agencies and shelters are expected to bring nearly 300 adoptable dogs and cats to the mall, all looking for prospective homes as part of the event put on by the San Diego Animal Support Foundation.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. And today, my very special guest is Joseph Rocha, a candidate running for the newly redrawn 40th State Senate District seat, which currently is held by Brian Jones. Joseph is a military veteran. He's served in both the Navy and the Marine Corps, working as a bomb dog handler, tracking down explosives in the Persian Gulf. I guess he's got the courage to be a politician now. And later, after obtaining his law degree, as a Marine Corps captain and prosecutor. His testimony was instrumental in the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the military's don't ask, don't tell policy. And now Joseph says he's committed to justice for everyone. Full disclosure, Joseph also served as an intern here at East County Magazine way back in 2008, interviewing candidates for Congress and local offices, and now he's running for one himself. He announced last year, actually, that he would run for Congress, but instead he has set his sights on the state legislature due to the redistricting. He says he's running to focus on jobs, housing, infrastructure, veterans, and climate change, among other important issues. So, Joseph, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Miriam, it's so wonderful to see you again. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're all real proud of everything you've accomplished since you left here. So let's start by talking about how the 40th State Senate District has changed with the redistricting. Can you tell us what communities are now included in it? And after that, what path for victory you envision here?
Yeah, absolutely. So our district, you know, to give you the visual, we start up north in Rainbow and we make our way down north in East County. We cover Fallbrook, Escondido, San Marcos, Poway, Ramona. We make our way down to Alpine Valley. And then what's thrown this district into the competitive realm is that it took a hard swing out to the coast all the way to University City. So we nearly reached UCSD's main campus just on the other side of the 5 freeway.
Wow. So that's a lot of new territory that Brian Jones has not represented before. It does still include here in East County, folks, the areas of Alpine, as he mentioned, Pine Valley, Mount Laguna, but then it snakes north. So it no longer includes places like, you know, El Cajon or a lot of the meat of the district. So it sounds like it's going to be a very interesting race.
That's right, Miriam. So just for reference, Brian won this district by only 3 points 4 years ago.
Wow.
And that was in a Biden plus one, in what would now be a Biden plus one, in what would have been a Republican registration advantage of 3 to 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
The new district that he's drawn into, I like to say, is not the district that elected into office 4 years ago, in that it's a Biden plus six, and it has nearly erased the Republican registration advantage. So if at all, it is at 0.06, not even a full percent.
Very interesting. So it's basically evenly divided among the two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. Fascinating.
That's right.
So tell us a little bit more about your background, your ties to the district, and how you think your experiences have qualified and prepared you to serve the people of this district in the state Senate, Joseph.
Yeah, so I had a very formative and challenging childhood that really led through into my career. But I'm very proud of. I think that the adversity in my life has given me the passion for justice and for service that I have today. So I'm second generation Mexican American. My family started in Northern California, just miles away from the capital, actually, in the fields and factories of Woodland and Davis. My mother raised me until I was seven. She was a grocery store worker, but she struggled with addiction and she lost me when I was seven. And then my father took me in Southern California, and I've been here ever since. You know, he raised a family of five, so his own two children and his wife and myself, with a truck driver's salary, which is nearly impossible nowadays.
Yeah.
So these, you know, bread and butter, working family issues and the middle class have been a core passion of mine since I can remember. When I was 17, I had to leave the home because I came out as gay. And I actually survived by working as a dishwasher. I stayed in high school for my senior year. I graduated and I joined the Navy. I joined the Navy because I wanted to go to the Naval Academy to be a Marine Corps officer. I became a military police officer because they were being deployed in high numbers at the time. I became a bomb dog handler because to increase my opportunities or chances to be deployed. And I went to Bahrain to get to Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So I spent 2.5 years doing explosive detection in the Middle East. Wow. And then following being accepted to the Naval Academy Preparatory School, no less, I was discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. As you mentioned, I was in the case, it's a federal court case, but a federal court case that was held here in Riverside, where I was a principal witness, and it ruled Don't Ask, Don't Tell unconstitutional. It was critical to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There had actually been a legislative vote prior to the ruling that had failed, and then it was put back up for a vote after, and obviously now having been ruled unconstitutional, it passed. For me, it was equally as important to be an example of positive out leadership as it was for us to be allowed to serve in the first place. So I went to law school, and in law school, I returned to the service. I commissioned as a Marine Corps officer. I served as a judge advocate. You know, a little bit about my Marine Corps bio. My first job was as the deputy legal assistance attorney for Mickey East, which is about 20,000 Marines. And legal assistance is basically your one-stop shop for all legal issues for the Marines.
Yeah, everything.
I like to equate it to constituent services, right? So one of the top jobs, most important jobs of a California state senator is constituent services, and it's connecting your constituents to the services of the state and helping lift them up. And I did that quite well. I actually earned the Legal Assistance Attorney of the Year award for 2019 and 2020 from the Commandant of the Marine Corps. Thank you. So from there, during the global shutdown, I was deployed to Central America. And I was the subject matter expert in embassy evacuations for the seven embassies that were there in Central America during the global shutdown. So that's when we were still trying to move troops, but also be prepared in these more unstable countries. If any of them were to collapse, how we would ultimately have to move American citizens back to the U.S. And then finally, I did my prosecution stint doing serious and sensitive felony crimes in Marine Corps prosecution.
So you've really been in a lot of the world's hot spots and also got a lot of good legal experience, which can certainly come in handy when drafting laws. We see some where it looks like maybe someone should have had more legal experience on occasion.
Yeah, no kidding. I know some people, you know, I think we get a bad rap. I certainly think that, you know, there's probably no good use for, you know, high paid corporate lawyers in public service. But I think it should be distinguished that public servant lawyers are very necessary in lawmaking. You know, you wouldn't ask, you know, why there's an engineer on building a bridge, right? You would want an engineer to help you build a bridge. I think that public servant lawyers are important to good policy and lawmaking.
Yeah. Well, speaking of policy and lawmaking, let's talk about some of the issues in the race. What ideas do you have, Joseph, to make housing more available and more affordable for new home buyers as well as for renters? You've said this would be a priority for you.
Yeah, so I'm a lifelong renter, but I also did own a home in my last duty station in North Carolina in Camp Lejeune. So I feel like I've experienced both sides of this equation. I think it's equally important that we increase access to first-time home buyer ownership. We know that that is the path to generational wealth in America, right? Owning property. Mm-hmm. And there are many communities that not only have not had access, but have been actively removed from access or barriers have been in place so that they can't have access to mortgages. And, you know, I think that's the first place we need to start in helping get people all on the same footing. With that, you know, obviously, I think we still have to have renter protections. How building more housing is obviously key to getting out of this housing crisis, but we also have to make sure that we're not just giving a windfall to developers to gouge and run renters into the ground, making...
Exactly, while taking all the parking in the neighborhood. We hear these complaints from people sometimes. And it's a really big challenge because it seems like no matter where you put the housing, there's often community resistance or other problems. We just saw a judge tell the supervisors they had to undo a big housing development out in Otay because it was a high fire danger and they had failed to consider what this would mean, you know, for everybody trying to evacuate on that roadway. And then when they try to put it in urban areas with maybe a high rise and say a suburban area, then people think it takes away community character or parking. So it's really a really difficult, I think one of the difficult, most difficult challenges that legislators face. And yet we have this housing shortage. It's really a crisis. So many people, young people especially, just priced out of the market completely.
Absolutely. There's no question that we are decades behind in our housing building. But there's definitely an appetite. There's a lot of activism, social justice activism, and community leadership to get through this. And I think that every time we run into a barrier like the ones that you mentioned, those are just opportunities for us to factor those into our next project so that they can stick and be successful and increase the housing market. Reducing red tape, which is heavy in Sacramento, is something that I'm very passionate about that would go a long way in solving most of our policy issues. And is something that I think as a Marine Corps officer, I would be well equipped to do.
Very good. San Diego County has one of the highest homeless rates, if not the highest homeless rate in the entire nation. And it's only gotten worse with the pandemic, with more people losing their homes. What's your approach or approaches, since it sometimes is a multifaceted problem, to keeping people from losing their homes in the first place and then to helping those who are homeless get off the streets?
So I think that one thing is there needs to be better communication between all levels of government. So the state, the county and the city, so that we're not wasting money, right? Nothing's more frustrating to taxpayers than seeing money wasted. So a better communication between all levels of government. At the core of all of our issues is going to be housing. We're going to come back to housing quite a bit today. Mm-hmm. So, obviously addressing that housing crisis and shortage. A lot of people who are homeless because, they just missed a mortgage payment or they missed a rental payment. They got sick. They ran out of paid sick leaves. They live alone. They have a family. These are compounding issues where, good, hardworking Americans who have paid their bills and who had done everything right come on hard times and then suddenly find themselves first living in their cars and then living on the streets. There's a level of compassion and empathy that needs to be had while I understand that the state is frustrated. And there's a level of action that needs to be had. Otherwise, the taxpayers are going to continue to be frustrated with us. I think that, continuing to move these mobile teams in the direction of mobile teams where we are deploying, healthcare services, mental health services, and drug addiction services, and connecting the homeless population to the services the state already provides that aren't being utilized to their full potential is important. And then lastly, just I think we could do more. Too large a population of our homeless are veterans. And I think that there's more that we could do in the transition phase of our service members to civilian life that would prevent this.
That was my next question, actually, was as a veteran yourself, what role do you see the state having to make sure that veterans, especially those recently returning vets coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq, many of them had very long deployments, you know, that they're getting the resources and help that they need, not only the homeless vets, but the ones that may have other issues.
Yeah. So this is something I'm really, that I feel very strongly about, and I love to talk about, which is, I think California needs to do more for our active duty service members. I think we need to build more rapport and better rapport with our service members. You know, I did serve on that joint deployment to Central America. So, and as a dog handler, we're trained by, and our classmates are from every service branch in Lackland. And so I've served with every branch of the military. And I'll tell you, the one thing that you know across all service branches is a service member from Texas will be the first to tell you that he's from Texas, right? And he'll be the first to tell you all the programs and all the benefits they get for being active duty in their state. Hmm. And that's something that I think would go a long way in this state, especially as we see radicalization creeping up in this state and in our district. And as we see, more radicalization within the ranks and within our veteran community, if there was a stronger relationship with our active duty service members, it would go a long way. So quickly, I'll just give you some examples. One, in Texas, service members, they get free tuition. That allows them to give their spouses or their children their GI Bill, which means that that's creating generational wealth, right?
Good idea. That's kind of a federal issue. Or is this something that the state can do?
No, that's something Texas does. So Texas is giving their service members free tuition. And because the federal government already gives a service member their GI Bill, which is a full ride, they are able to roll over that GI Bill to a family member, an immediate family member. And so that helps that go a long way. We've seen here, particularly in San Diego, I think we have all been very alarmed and upset to find out how much food insecurity there is within the lower ranks of our service members. So, you know, targeting as a state, the employment of spouses would go a long way in helping these families be able to provide for their families. And so just those little things, I think there's a long way that we can go in creating a little bit stronger of a relationship with our active duty service members.
Very good. Let's see. You've mentioned you wanted to focus on creating good paying jobs, and including here in the San Diego region. Can you elaborate a little bit on what your plan might include?
Yeah, so that's actually exactly where we left off. So there is a difference between employment and gainful employment, right? Yeah. So a person who has 2 to 3 jobs and never sees their family, has no paid sick leave, has no vacation days, has no healthcare benefits, is employed, but they're not gainfully employed.
Right. Flipping hamburgers and driving Uber is just not going to support a family in this economy.
So people should be able to have a single job that provides for their family. That would be a focus of mine in the state. I'm a strong supporter of unions, and I would be a champion for unions in the state. They built the middle class. My family obviously once made their way up to the middle class and enjoyed a middle class that was very different from the one that we have now, if at all.
Yeah, your dad was a trucker. Was he a Teamster?
My dad did. He was a member of the union when he was younger. And my mother was a grocery store worker, and then grandparents, farmers and factory workers. So, yeah. These were good, hard, honest jobs that could provide for a family and either hardly can or cannot anymore. And so we need to fix that. And the hollowing out of the middle class is also at the core of a lot of our woes in the state and at the federal, at a national level, right? As we see rich people get richer and working class families work themselves more into the ground with no light in sight, that creates frustration and it also divides us. So, worker protections, rebuilding the middle class and looking out for those working class families, making sure that the opportunity that allowed me to be the first person to go to community college, law school. And while there's a history of service in my family, the first person to become an officer, that I want to make sure that opportunity exists for our next generation.
Yeah, those are very worthy goals. Infrastructure is another priority that you have listed on your website, Joseph. Our region has a lot of infrastructure needs, from obviously things like improving mass transit, gridlock on ending the gridlock on Highway 52, but also protecting the public from, we're researching a story now on two aging dams, one at El Capitan, one at Lake Hodges, both of which are very near active earthquake faults that are capable of
that.
We had one right near there the other day, and it's capable of about a 7.8 quake. And these are both ranked as extremely dangerous by the state, both in terms of the condition of these old earthen dams that are crumbling away and how many people would die if they were ever to, you know, to break. So given that backdrop, I would like to ask what you think should be priority projects for our region. And would you fight specifically to get some funding to start repairing these dams, especially El Capitan? I think there's a little bit of a plan in progress for Hodges now, but nothing on the horizon that I've heard of for El Capitan, which is the worst of all of them out here in Lakeside. But if it flooded, it would basically wipe out Mission Valley, you know, all the way down.
Yeah. So in the congressional run, I was a strong supporter of the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, no less. Mm-hmm. And that has obviously unlocked a tremendous amount of resources and funds to the states. And that will make its way down to the county and the city, but not if we don't fight for it, right? So mm-hmm. I would absolutely fight for resources for the district as hard as I've fought for everything else. And I, you know, I'd be a great advocate for the community up in Sacramento. As far as priorities go, you know, they're equal. I mean, it's as equally important for you to be able to get to your children and pick them up from school as it is to make sure that you, you know, your house doesn't get washed away. You know, something that as a Marine is very important to me is listening to experts and leaders. And so, again, back to that communication piece between the city, the county, and the state, you know, I'm sure they're getting engineering reports about all of these projects and which are pose a greater threat to the community, and those should be prioritized.
Okay, thank you. You've mentioned common sense solutions to tackle climate change. This is one area where I believe you and the incumbent Ryan Jones probably differ sharply. At least some years ago when I interviewed him, he was a climate change denier, basically did not think it was real or did not think it was that man was contributing to it. I don't know if he's softened or changed on that through the years, but I would like to know what solutions you would support to tackle climate change and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. And that said, without imposing undue burdens on those who can least afford it, an example being, for example, the proposed mileage tax, where a lot of the rural residents could be stuck paying $1,000 a year and yet not benefiting from the mass transit project. So it's another thorny issue, but obviously it's a global concern. What are the answers that you would support?
Yeah, so last I checked, I believe that Brian was rated 8% for his legislative record on the environment. He also prides himself on being a supporter of firefighters. You cannot be a climate change denier and be a supporter of firefighters. Our state is facing, you know, these increasingly dangerous and larger fires every single year. I was talking to a firefighter, an older firefighter leader recently, and he told me that, you know, when he was a kid, you almost wished that one day you could be a part of a big fire just to sort of cut your teeth and earn your credibility within the fire community. And nowadays, we lose more firefighters to suicide than we do to the fires because of the back-to-back rapid deployment cycles that they are facing. And Southern California,
as well as lung damage, a lot of them are dying of cancer because of all the exposure to repeated, really large fires and all of the chemicals and all of the smoke.
That's exactly right. And they're having to fight those things out. And the threshold for them proving that their cancers are related to the fires are too high. So that's a separate issue that I'm very supportive of. So, you know, and it also affects our senior citizens, right? So as every year our winters get colder and our summers get hotter, particularly our summers in a state that really wasn't built to have air conditioning. You know, Southern California in particular, mm-hmm. San Diego, a lot of our homes don't have air conditioning because it was never hot enough to need that here. And so we have senior citizens who it becomes a life or death issue. So as far as the common sense, you know, solutions go, I think that you know, these things have to be prioritized as commitments to our communities. Mm-hmm. And first and foremost, to your point of who's carrying the burden, corporations have to pay their fair share. We are the fifth largest economy in the world, last time I checked, and corporations are just not paying their fair share. I mean, in fact, for a while, they weren't even reporting what their carbon emissions were. I think that the Capitol just was successful in passing a law to ensure that. So you know, I think that's where we start. And we go from there. I think there's a lot of things that we can do. Say again?
What about making sure that we retain the incentives for solar? We're seeing some efforts up in Sacramento to erode that by the utility companies right now, to erode the profits that a homeowner could make by selling their solar back to the grid, which of course is one of the big incentives for getting solar other than the altruistic motives.
Well, and that goes just right back to corporate greed, right? So the electric company is saying that they're not getting enough money for the power, while they're also still shirking and ignoring their responsibility to the crumbling infrastructure of the power grid, which they refuse, just keep pushing off and off, saying it's too expensive while it gets more expensive. And, you know, that's another example of that is the oil and gas companies where we're seeing them having skyrocketing profits while gas is going up. So is gas going up because it needs to go up or because we're allowing these companies to continue to run us dry?
Yeah. On another issue, Joseph, you've been a champion for equality, having, as we mentioned earlier, won your own hard-fought battle to end discrimination in the military against LGBTQ soldiers. I wonder how that experience has impacted your life and your goal of fighting for equal rights for everybody in an era when, as you mentioned, we're seeing a rise in hate groups, including right here in East County, where we've seen, you know, attacks and discrimination on not only people in the gay community, but also Jews, Black people, Asians, Latinos, and immigrants, just to name a few, within the last couple of years here, synagogues defaced, you know. What's your take on that?
My take is that, you know, first and foremost, what drives me absolutely nuts is the inability of people who are in positions of leadership being unable to condemn these actions, right? It is the absolute bare minimum that these so-called leaders could do. And for political reasons, which if you start digging into that, why would you think there would be political backlash for you to denounce neo-Nazism or radicalization? That should be equally alarming. So anyhow, that's where it starts, right? And obviously that's something that I'm not afraid to do. When we met, I think I hadn't done it yet, but I was close to having taken a national stage in fighting for equal rights for LGBTQ plus service members. And that was on a national stage. It was post a George Bush administration. And a chairman of the Joint Chiefs that had said that homosexuality was immoral. So, you know, I was 10 years younger, had no team, and was exposed to the wrath of the darkest, you know, parts of the internet for quite some time. So
you've experienced that sort of being a target of hate speech,
right?
You know, and
so
probably threats yourself.
Exactly. So 10 years later, and now with a team, and having been a Marine Corps officer and all of that, I'll tell you, you know, skin as thick as a rhino. We have had numerous death threats in the congressional here in the district. Nothing
terrible
has or will stop me from, my commitment and dedication to service in the community. And that extends to everyone, because it's when these things occur to you, it doesn't make you try to find people like you to protect you and them. It builds your empathy towards any shared experience with other communities. So, you know, we've seen this hate towards the Arab community, the Muslim community, Jewish community. This district has picked up a large API community, which due to the previous leadership at the highest levels, the way that they racialized and mishandled COVID created more hate within or against the Asian community.
Yeah, and disabled people, we should mention. There's even been, you know, hate, even the past president mocking a disabled reporter.
That's right.
Shocking, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, I think you can't make up for lived experience. This is something that I've shown, you know, I have experienced the darkest sides of this. It is something that I am passionate about and I've dedicated my life to. And I would love to put that spirit and that fight to the service of this community in the Capitol.
Okay. And protecting the rights of everyone. As we do this interview, we are still in a global pandemic due to COVID-19 with yet another surge of a new variant, Omicron. There's been a lot of controversy over just how far the state should go with things like vaccine mandates, mask mandates, protecting public health against personal freedoms. There's also been controversies about, you know, shutdowns of business, how many, how long, which obviously shutdowns probably saved lives, but also caused economic harm to a lot of mom and pop businesses and even some larger companies. So I would like to ask Joseph, what are your views about how best to balance those competing needs, if they should be balanced, and how you believe we should be addressing the pandemic and any new needs that the pandemic itself may have created?
So I feel like we could spend an hour on this at minimum, yeah. Right? But briefly, you know, my brain is firing off in a million different directions. I think that...
Yeah, apologies. It was kind of a complex question.
But. No, that's quite all right. And I, you know, it's something that I'm excited to address. So I think that first and foremost, we've learned a lot of lessons from the pandemic. And I think it's important to carry those on with us and not to forget them. I think it's also important to evolve with the pandemic. So restrictions that were put in place 2 years ago now may not be practical 2 years later based on the new variant that we're dealing with.
Right. Plus we have vaccines and things we didn't have, tools we didn't have in the very
that's
beginning.
That's exactly right.
At least can help fight it.
Yeah. And something, you know, I think that we have to really keep an eye on is, again, back to the radicalization, this faction's very keen ability to find stress and then direct it direct it in ways that divide us, right? So the politicization, difficult word, of the pandemic has been mm-hmm. very disheartening, right? It really should have been a 9/11 where we really come together as a country to lift each other out of this very difficult time. And unfortunately, you know, due to certain forces, it was manipulated just to divide us further. But I think the good thing that we've seen out of these challenges in the last 2 years is that it's brought attention to things that we had been either willfully ignoring or ignorant to. And that's a lot of the struggles of our underserved and underrepresented populations, working class people, things like paid sick leave, things like childcare, things like
so important.
Yeah,
technology in the home for school kids who suddenly are you know had to study at home. Quite
exactly often. Right. Broadband, internet, and I keep thinking there's something that keeps escaping my mind, but you know, access to healthcare, and who is an essential worker, right? And that's something I'm very very glad of is that finally, you know, grocery store workers and nurses and teachers are getting their day. But, you know, sending a tweet out or saying that, again, it goes back to the firefighter things that I mentioned earlier. It's like saying you support these communities, but doing absolutely nothing legislatively in the Capitol to ensure that they receive the protections and dignity that they deserve is not enough. And so that's something that I, you know, is very important to me.
Okay. Speaking of healthcare, which is, of course, so important, a bill that would have provided universal health care for all Californians died yesterday. You know, the show is taped, but yesterday as we're taping it, without coming to a vote in the full assembly up in Sacramento after the author had to withdraw it because there was not quite enough support for passage. So I would like to ask Joseph, do you think that health care for all Californians is a goal we should work toward? And if so, is it affordable? It goes to, I guess, both, you know, is it a good idea? And is it something that is practical economically?
So again, on this one, I would lean on experts and scientists and doctors in the community. However, broadly speaking, it is a part of our democratic platform that healthcare is a universal right. And so working towards that goal, I think, is important. And I think it's exciting and encouraging that we saw such a bold attempt here. I think that's something that's very important. When we see the surplus that we have in our as a state, but we see continue to live with these issues, faith is being lost in our system. And so we have to take more bold actions. Piecemealing things is just not moving fast enough. We need to take more bold actions to show the results to the state so that the state can continue trusting us. It's a relationship, and that's very important. So I think that this is encouraging and that we will see more proposals on how to increase access to and make healthcare affordable in the state. There's things that while this is dead for now, I hope that we prioritize other things rapidly, such as, decreasing the cost of prescription medications in the state for our seniors and our low-income people. So I think we're headed in the right direction. I think there were too many questions. Again, as we talked about with COVID and other policies, such as housing, I hope that we learn from where we fell short so that we can come back with a more perfect product in the future. There were a lot of questions as to where the revenue was going to come for this bill, whether people are going to be able to stay on their private healthcare if they wanted to, and whether the state had the infrastructure and the staffing, which is something that is endlessly frustrating to me as a service member, someone who has been in the federal government system. When you see big systems that implement programs but don't have the staffing and resources to actually do them effectively. So did we or do we have, or what are we doing to create a infrastructure, a human infrastructure, prepared to take on a single payer statewide system?
Yeah, staffing in the middle of the pandemic is an issue. It seems like in every industry. I just went through it with trying to get emergency care for my dog, and you can't get appointments anywhere for weeks. It's just affecting, it seems like, every aspect of our lives right now. So maybe it was just a particularly difficult year to try to get this through, but perhaps in the future that would be different.
I'm sorry to hear about your pet. But that goes to, something we focus on a lot as service members is second and third order effects, right? Mm-hmm. We like to say good intentions, bad idea. It is very important to me, particularly as a legislator, if I'm so lucky to serve as, is that we're not creating more problems than we're solving just to, have, an exciting legislative piece that we can put our name to and say we did a thing, right? We have
the devil's in the details, basically.
Exactly right.
Yeah. It's interesting that on a day when we're all talking about whether or not we could have afforded a universal health care bill or not, your opponent, State Senator Brian Jones, came out with a video that he sent out to all of his constituents this morning, arguing that the budget surplus should be divided up and $1,125 should just be sent to every Californian. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, he represents a party that just allowed the child tax credit, which is $600 a month, to expire, and that we are now seeing is crippling.
At the federal level, we should clarify.
Right.
But yeah.
Right. Is causing much distress within families. So I'm not entirely sure how he thinks that $1,100 is going to solve institutional shortfalls of the state. It's just one more way to take the easy way out when faced with very difficult issues.
There you go. What else would you like our readers to know about you and your candidacy for the 40th State Senate District that I maybe haven't asked, Joseph? And can you tell readers where they can find more information on your candidacy? And by the way, viewers, listeners, if you are tuning in late, we are speaking with Joseph Rocha, who is a Democratic candidate running in the newly redrawn 40th State Senate District. district currently represented by Brian Jones, but it's shifting westward. So it's going to have less of East County and more of the coastal communities, as well as portions of North County.
Yeah. So readers or listeners.
It's all of them, really. It'll be on our website, on our radio show. We'll have a video posted online, too.
Exactly. So you all can learn more, hopefully, you know, join in, learn more, support us at rochaforsenate.com, R-O-C-H-A for Senate.com. You know, again, we've been talking a lot just about empathy and lived experience. And I think that those are things that you can't make up for. I've dedicated my life to service. I've gone through some tremendously difficult challenges and emerged stronger for it. I'm very proud of them. And I'm not afraid of anything. And I don't let things get in my way of helping my community. So, you know, something we do have a more moderate conservative base here in our district. I've lived in and thrived in conservative spaces all my life, having just left the Marine Corps as a captain and a prosecutor. You know, I am a member of the VFW and the American Legion here. And I'll just say a certain someone came up to me and he said, do you know how some of the older vets refer to you here? And I was like, no, how? And I wasn't entirely sure. And I just kind of held my breath. And they say about you, he might be a Democrat, but he's a Marine. And that's the confidence that we have built over the past 7 months on our campaign in the district, where we've led with common sense. We've led with unity. We've led with focusing on the kitchen table issues. How do we help you provide for your family? Where are the services falling short of helping you get ahead? And I think that, you know, we've seen it really resonate. Our district covers Miramar, which I would be tremendously proud to represent and make sure that the sailors and Marines and employees there have everything they need from the state to succeed. You know, we have fantastic universities and community colleges, which I was lucky enough to attend. Our community college and our university systems here in the region. And so, I invite people along. This is a textbook battleground race now, right? So it's an even registration, Republican, Democrat, with a large independent population that leans Democrats. And my task is to go out there, prove myself, earn that trust. And I'm confident that I can do that. And I think it would go a long way for this region to elect a Latino LGBTQ plus veteran of the Navy and the Marine Corps in our region, our state, and in our country. You know, I think this is the future of the Democratic Party. We cannot be the party of major cities on the coast. We have to start showing our ability to lead and serve in spaces that are more moderate and conservative and change what people think of as Democratic leadership.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Joseph, for taking the time to join us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
His decision to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court is literally going to change the face of the court for the future and for our history in the United States.
Democratic Illinois Senator Dick Durbin met with President Joe Biden Thursday to discuss the upcoming Supreme Court vacancy, with Justice Stephen Breyer retiring in June. Potential nominees include D.C. Court of Appeals Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger, and U.S. District Court Judge Michelle Childs of South Carolina. Democratic New York Senator Carolyn Maloney, who chairs the House Oversight Committee, sent a letter to the National Archives seeking answers about the removal of White House documents to former President Trump's Florida residence, Mar-a-Lago. Meanwhile, in Queensbridge, New York, Maloney introduced the Preventing Pretrial Gun Purchases Act while speaking at a rally on gun violence.
If we could pass gun safety laws, we could save lives. It's that simple.
At a community college in Culpeper, Virginia, President Biden addressed the high cost of insulin, healthcare premiums, surprise billing, and price transparency. Biden noted more than 300,000 Virginians signed up for ACA coverage during the open enrollment period and said his administration aims to lower costs for the average American.
And we want to go further. Lower prescription drug prices, get a cap on the amount people pay on Medicare, pay for prescription drugs, and to bring more clarity and fewer surprises when you get your bills if you've been hospitalized.
Former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson spoke on Capitol Hill Thursday after the Senate passed legislation ending forced arbitration in sexual misconduct cases.
And I believe this bill will also have a dual effect. It's going to help companies get on the right side of history, that's for sure. But it will also stop the bad behavior, because now the bad actors will know that women's voices will be heard.
Carlson said she learned in 2016 she could not sue her former employer, Fox News chief Roger Ailes, for harassment, but instead had to go into forced arbitration. Finally, as it starts to accept this year's returns, the IRS is still working through returns filed last year, requiring manual processing. The backlog has now been trimmed from 35 million to 6 million returns. Erin Collins with the Taxpayer Advocate Service says the agency is underfunded and understaffed.
Please file electronically this year. Paper is not the IRS's friend. I have been saying that it's the IRS's kryptonite, and there's piles of it, and they're struggling to get through it.
I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
A bill will soon be introduced in the California legislature that would grant low-income students at 5 Cal State University campuses a stipend of $500 a month for basic living expenses. The idea is to provide a universal basic income so more students can afford to stay in school. State Senator Dave Cortese says the pilot program would serve about 14,000 students, or about 11% of the campus population.
Because that's roughly the percentage of students who were essentially in abject poverty. They're either homeless or severely at risk of being homeless.
To qualify, the student would have to have a household income below $20,000. The program would cost the state an estimated $84 million a year. Opponents of universal basic income criticize it as a government handout that could be squandered. However, Cortese says data from two such programs launched in Stockton and Santa Clara County do not support that concern. Many campuses in the state already provide housing referrals, food banks, and other resources to students in need, but they vary widely. Cortese says if the bill passes and the universal basic income program ends up working successfully to reduce poverty and dropout rates in the Cal State system, it could be expanded.
If it is effective, you don't want to be doing it on all campuses, and probably extended to community colleges as well.
The specific schools that would take part in the 3-year pilot have not been announced. The legislative deadline to file bills is a week from Friday. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.